the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California power companies have a difficult dilemma. Avoid sparking wildfires while also trying to avoid shutoffs. One of the biggest utilities in the state has been thinking about this for more than a decade now. We'll hear about some of the things they're doing to try and get their customers relief from both fires and blackouts. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Hey, it's Tuesday, Take Two Tuesday. Thanks for choosing us today. We got a packed show for you today. Coming up, we find out why so many cities take styrofoam to-go containers in their recycling bins, even though if almost none of it is actually recycled. More on that in about half an hour. Plus, as we head into tonight's Democratic presidential debate, where four of the 12 candidates on stage are women, we speak with comedian, actor, and now author June Diane Raphael about her new book, Represent, The Women's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. So make sure you stay with us. But we're going to start with some grim numbers about sexual assault on college campuses. According to a national survey out today of more than 181,000 students, one in four female undergraduates say they have been sexually assaulted by force or without their consent. The study comes from the Association of American Universities, a leading researcher in higher education. But USC gathered their own numbers, and the statistics were even worse. One in three female students said they were sexually assaulted sometime during their college careers. Joining us is Dr. Sarah Van Orman, who oversees student health services at USC. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
These numbers are alarming. Some of them have even called this a public health crisis on college campuses. Were you surprised by this information, Doctor?
No. Unfortunately, we know that sexual assault and misconduct is the most common, one of the most common public health crises. Situations we see on our campuses. We see this every day in our clinical practice, and we see the impact it has on students in terms of their personal health, their emotional health, and their academic progress. Unfortunately, these numbers reinforce what we know is happening both at USC but also nationally.
Now, what's driving these numbers, do you think? Is it just they're getting reported more or happening more? Maybe a combination of both.
Well, one of the things that we noticed between the 2015 and the 2019 survey, both at USC as well as in the national data, is that we actually didn't see any much change in the prevalence. In fact, at USC, we saw about a 1% increase. Nationally, there was between a 2 to 3% increase in the reports from undergraduate female-identified students. So although many of our campuses have put a lot of resources into prevention, into education, into investigation, we're not yet seeing the impacts of that. I think these numbers suggest that there's a lot more work that we have to do.
Do you think it just is going to take time? Or, I mean, I would think if things are being done, that the numbers wouldn't get higher at all.
Yeah, one of the things that is important is that the increased attention to this in the last 5 to 10 years, and including the 2015 survey, has really opened up the field of research, and particularly trying to better understand what works in the field of prevention, what works in the field of response. So I am actually optimistic that we as a community, as a field in higher education, are going to make progress. But it's going to take years and increased efforts on our part.
Talking to Dr. Sarah Van Orman, who oversees student health services at USC. Now, one of the brighter spots here was that students, according to the survey, have a much better understanding of sexual misconduct and also assault. And I understand that USC is rolling out a training for new students explaining what consent means. What is this program, and what's different about this program from the ones we've seen before?
Yeah, this fall, for the first time, incoming first-year students are required to participate in an in-person program that talks about what consent is, that gives them skills to negotiate consent with their partners, as well as helping them understand campus resources and what campus expectations are. This adds to existing efforts we've had through a required online training. We know that if we're going to change attitudes, knowledge, and behavior in these areas, that one single experience isn't going to do that, but we want to think about how we deliver multiple doses to students through their time here. Those kinds of sustained comprehensive efforts are what we believe will really make a difference in terms of the numbers on our campus.
Now, the survey also suggests that many still do not report incidents or use university resources for support because they don't feel like they can. Doctor, what's your response to that?
Absolutely. So about a third of students indicated that they had reported it. We're very happy to hear that that number has actually doubled for women and tripled for men since the 2015 survey. So we've made some progress. But what that also means is that two-thirds of students actually didn't report to a university resource. The survey gives us information as to why, and that's really going to inform our action items on this as we move forward.
Now, USC has been in the spotlight in the past for not being transparent. Allegations against former campus gynecologist George Tyndall come to mind, Doctor. Do you think that that has contributed to maybe the reluctance of students coming forward?
Yeah, so certainly we know that trust on the community is something that USC is on a journey to repair. As the survey suggested, did show increases in the number of students that we're reporting. But we also know that our experiences as a campus is going to require a lot more efforts over the next several years to help students know that we're responsive, that we listen. The sharing of the data in the public way, we had large town hall I just walked out of. Those are part of our efforts to make sure that when we have this information, we share it with our community, and we are transparent in what we're doing, what we're not doing, and what we need to grow and improve in.
One more thing, Doctor, on the issue of trust. I know USC has a new president. What conversations are happening at the very, very top to try and improve this situation and help the school win back the trust of their students?
I can tell you that I know from personal communication with President Folt that she is deeply committed to these issues and the student experience and all aspects of that student experience, including on this very important topic. I know that she understands these issues from her experience as a higher education leader, and both at the sort of numbers level, but also the personal experience of students. So I think we have a leader at USC that is going to help us move forward on these issues.
That's Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Chief Health Officer at USC, telling us about what's being done at the college regarding sexual assault. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Today, the Los Angeles City Council approved a measure to block no-fault evictions. It's in response to reports that landlords in LA have been trying to evict tenants prior to a new law going into effect in January that would cap rent increases. Councilman Mitch O'Farrell proposed the measure. Councilman, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. Yes, and what this moratorium does actually is it would go into effect in an emergency situation in Los Angeles so that landlords could not engage in just cause evictions.
Have you been hearing that evictions are happening or that landlords are trying to evict people before this law goes into effect in January?
We have, by the hundreds, if not thousands. So since the governor signed the bill 1 week ago today, we've heard lots of stories, entire buildings getting just cause eviction notices, which is why we need to act so quickly.
When we knew that this measure was at least on his desk, were conversations being had to have this ready to go? I mean, that seemed like it would have been the next logical step for a lot of landlords.
Well, there was a motion that was introduced a year ago that could have taken care of this, but it did not make its way out of the Housing Committee on the LA City Council. So we're playing catch up. I don't sit on that housing committee, and a lot of us are feeling very restless about that issue, but we can put that to the side for a moment. What the state did not do with this bill is they did not insert their own emergency clause, unlike what they did with the CEQA exemptions to build permanent supportive housing. They did insert an emergency clause in that law, which was signed a couple of weeks ago, and that's in effect immediately. However, that clause did not was not incorporated into AB 1482. So that means the city, we have to act quickly to give these protections before the January 1st, 2020 effectuation date.
Talking to LA City Councilman Mitch O'Farrell. So what would your measure do to prevent landlords from removing residents right now?
So it would be an emergency moratorium, and the sooner we can get this adopted, the better. What we did today was we took unanimous action for the city attorney to draft an ordinance, and then we instructed the city attorney to identify the possibilities of making findings that because hundreds, if not thousands, of notices have already gone out by some of the predatory landlords to evict existing tenants in these buildings that are currently not protected, to make findings that that harms the greater public good. So we've instructed the city attorney's office to consider all options so that we can make it retroactive to the date that the governor signed the bill, which is 1 week ago today.
Does your ordinance address landlords that have, say, legitimate evictions? Maybe someone hasn't paid rent in a long time or is damaging property.
It doesn't venture into that territory whatsoever. What we want to do is put a stop to the landlords who, and there is a universe of them, who simply because they know that they can make more money and they know that they'll be held to account as of January 1st, we want to put a stop to that universe of landlords out just to make as much money as they can at the expense of people who are already marginalized. The punctuation point to all this is Los Angeles is already currently experiencing a displacement crisis. We've been in that situation for a number of years. So to have this happen on top of what's already happening here, because we have not had the ability, because of state law called Coastal Hawkins, we haven't had the ability to enact additional rent protections through our existing rent stabilization ordinance for any building built after 1978. State law actually prohibits the city from adding to that inventory. So at least this AB 1482, the David Chu bill, will give protections to renters up to 2004.
We're going to have to leave it right there. That's LA City Councilman Mitch O'Farrell proposing a new ordinance to prevent evictions in LA. Councilman, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, more Take Two coming up in about 60 seconds. Don't go anywhere. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Saddle Ridge fire that scorched the San Fernando Valley Hills last week may have started under a high-voltage transmission tower. So says the Los Angeles Fire Department. Southern California Edison owns the tower. The cause of that fire, though, is under investigation. And it comes on the heels of massive shutoffs in the northern part of the state as the utility Pacific Gas and Electric tried to prevent more fires. Between the shutoffs and the fires, a lot of people are probably asking the same thing this week. Is this just a taster of what we're in for? Michael Wera specializes in climate and energy policy. He's a senior research scholar at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, it's been a tumultuous week for both residents and power utilities in California. Just start us off, Michael. How do we end up at a point where millions of lives are either affected by power outages or wildfires?
Well, I think there are three factors that have combined to land us in a situation where it's really unprecedented. The first is the fact that our power grid is a piece of aging infrastructure that's starting to show its age and where there's a lot of deferred maintenance. The second factor is the pattern of development that the state has undertaken over the last four decades, where we've built many, many homes and many communities in areas that are exposed to fire risk. And the third is climate change. which, you know, has loaded the dice in favor of very dangerous wildfire seasons that make choices that might have been okay, choices to have older infrastructure, choices to live in potentially dangerous areas. It's made those choices really unacceptable. And that's why we're living through the situation that we're in now, where the electricity system is really compromised.
Now, looking up north, our Governor Gavin Newsom doled out some criticism of PG&E last week, saying that the blame for the power outages that affected over a million people lays on the shoulders of the utility. Here's a clip of that.
This is not, from my perspective, a climate change story as much as a story about greed and mismanagement over the course of decades. Neglect, a desire to advance not public safety, but profits.
Michael, any merit to those criticisms? Is there evidence of greed or mismanagement?
Well, I think it's important for listeners to understand that companies that are regulated by the PUC, PG&E, Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, are only allowed to make as much money in profit as the Public Utility Commission allows. While I think it may not be fair to say that, you know, greed has been a driving force for PG&E, I do agree with Governor Newsom that management has certainly been an issue. And significantly, the fact that PG&E management really missed early signals that this was a growing risk that they needed to take kind of emergency action to avert. That puts us now in a situation where we have many years of work to kind of dig ourselves out of this hole we're in, perhaps in the meantime, enduring blackouts to avoid catastrophe.
A lot of major electrical utilities of the state are concerned about wildfires. Some have taken more steps than others, and I want to look at one in particular, San Diego Gas and Electric. They announced plans for a fire science lab today. They're also going to partner with academics, public safety officials, and it turns out they've been working on this issue for quite a long time. How is their trajectory as a utility different from the others in the state?
Well, San Diego Gas and Electric went through a very traumatic experience in 2007, where its lines caused a fire that killed a number of people and destroyed hundreds of homes. It was the Witch Fire. And after that, the company decided to really change course. They recognized that wildfire risk for them threatened really their social license to operate, right? The idea that it would be okay for a profit-making company to serve electricity. This type of thing just couldn't happen again, in their view. And so they developed a process that over time has led to lots of different kinds of new technologies deployed in their system, but it's really targeted at every year reducing the risks that something like the Witch Fire would ever happen again in San Diego. And I think many would say that they have been incredibly successful, that they are a leader in wildfire safety for utilities. And PG&E and Edison's approach is basically a scaled up version of what San Diego has developed over the last 10 years.
But you said San Diego Gas and Electric, they felt it important to kind of justify their social license to operate. How does that kind of culture take place in a place like San Diego Gas and Electric?
Well, I think it was a real challenge, you know, and the kind of approach to safety that SDG&E has, where they're very open that, you know, there is still an ongoing risk of fire in their service territory, and that's unacceptable. And they quantify that risk every year, and their goal for the year is to reduce it, right? And to quantify the reduction so that next year they start out at a better place and can keep over time improving their operations. That kind of process-based management is not typical for the utility space, especially the management of wires. And it's probably the hardest thing to create. The safety culture that enables is the hardest thing to create within a company.
And you mentioned how they've been working on this for over a decade. Is that the sort of time it takes for utility to make the necessary changes?
Well, it's a rough amount of time that PG&E has estimated it will take to just install the hardware in the field that PG&E thinks is necessary now. I think changes of culture are perhaps even more challenging than simply deploying, you know, new kinds of technologies in the field.
We're speaking to Michael Wara. He specializes in climate and energy policy. He's also a senior research scholar at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment. Now, looking at PG&E and Southern California Edison, what can they do to prevent shutoffs and fires?
Well, over time, there are a number of steps they can take. There's lots that they're already doing, like improving their vegetation management, spending a lot more attention focused on trees and keeping trees out of wires. They can help to reduce the impacts of these blackouts when they're necessary by providing backup power to kind of vulnerable customers, you know, people with medical devices, and they can work to redesign their grids so that they're essentially broken up into smaller pieces such that only the pieces that are located in high-risk areas can be turned off and everything else can stay on through a wind event. Right now, both Edison and PG&E suffer from the fact that their grids were not built with fire in mind. And so when they need to switch off a particular wire, it might involve switching off wires that are adjacent to it or even many miles away because they're on the same circuit.
Now, looking ahead, Michael, utilities are working on ways to prevent catastrophe. How long before we might see some relief from blackouts and fires, or is that just pie in the sky?
I think what we're likely to see is a gradually improving situation where the utilities do the things to their grid that they need to maybe keep the power on more of the time, and when they have to black it out, to black out fewer customers. And that will reduce the impacts of these power shutoffs and increase safety for everyone. That is going to take probably the better part of a decade to really get to where San Diego Gas and Electric is now, where San Diego has really identified where the risky spots are and they've designed their circuits to not cause problems for their customers when they have to turn off particular elements of their system. It's going to take PG&E and Edison a long time to get there, both because they're starting essentially where San Diego was 10 years ago today, and because they have much bigger and more complex service territories.
That's Michael Wara. He specializes in climate and energy policy, is also a senior research scholar at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment. Michael, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow on the show, we'll hear directly from the Director of Fire Science and Climate Adaptation at San Diego Gas and Electric. Now to emergency alerts. The Saddle Ridge Fire erupted last Thursday in Sylmar. It's now 45% contained. At one point, though, there were 11 different evacuation centers offering shelter to displaced residents and their animals. But as often happens in these fast-moving fire events, there were reports of confusion among residents about who needed to get to, and where they should go. For a closer look at that, we have Kate Hutton. She's the Emergency Management Coordinator for the City of L.A. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you.
Now, to be clear, your department is just in charge of getting the word out about the evacuations. You have no say in what areas are evacuated. Now, that being said, what were all of the different methods your department used to alert residents in the mandatory evacuation areas?
The first method we used was wireless emergency alerts. And so those are very similar to the Amber alerts you get on your cell phones. Mm-hmm. Those are going to go to every cell phone in a prescribed area that we set, and they're going to hopefully wake you up from a deep sleep, especially when those alerts are going out at 11 p.m., 1 a.m.
So those break through no matter what, unless maybe is your phone off? Can you still get them, or does your phone have to be on?
You know, your phone does have to be on, okay. And you have to have not opted out. So I know a lot of people, they get alert fatigue. They get all the Amber alerts. They get all these alerts all the time, and they say, enough, I don't want any more. We ask that you don't do that, because then when incidents like the Saddle Ridge Fire happen, we can't get a hold of you.
Okay, so that's one way. What are some of the other ways?
We also rely a lot on traditional media. You guys out in the media are really great about helping us spread the word, but door knocks as well.
Okay.
You know, we have police and fire out in the field knocking on individual doors, and we rely on our friends and neighbors too. You know, if you get an alert and you hear that it's time to evacuate, make sure that people in your family network, your friend network, your neighbor network know about that as well.
So texts, media, and actually going up to people and saying, hey, you need to leave.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Now, today, one of our editors mentioned she saw an ad on television with Mayor Eric Garcetti asking residents to sign up for emergency alerts. Is that new? Asking sign-ups now?
We do have an opt-in system called Notify LA. And with that system, we can actually reach you via text message, a phone call, an email. There's an app, and it's really great for people who need TTY devices as well. We can get a lot more information to you. One of the...
What's that, a TTY?
TTY, TTD are devices that help people who are deaf or hard of hearing get those emergency notifications. So we really strive to make sure that our emergency notifications are getting to as many people as possible on as many methods as possible. And opting into that Notify LA system is the best way to ensure that you're going to get alerts that are specific to you, your needs, and where you are. In that Notify LA system, you can actually provide addresses. So maybe you live, work, and go to school in Los Angeles. You can give us an address for each of those locations, and you'll receive alerts specific to those addresses. And with the wireless emergency alerts, the Amber alert style ones, they're really great for hitting a large amount of people, but they aren't very specific, right? You're going to be hitting a wide swath of people with about 90 characters. It's not going to give you all the information we want to get you. And so opting to that Notify Notify LA system allows us to get you a little bit more specific, a little bit more detailed information.
Okay, what about residents who are older? Maybe they don't have a smartphone or know how to do the opt-in to alert services. What does your department do to ensure that they are informed?
Part of the Notify LA system does have basically a reverse 911, a callback system. We can call people on landlines, on VOIP, things like that. Of course, it's best if you opt into the system because then your phone number is tied into your contact information, your address. But we do have some ways to hit people who haven't opted in who are on landlines as well.
We're talking to Kate Hutton with the Los Angeles Emergency Management Department. Now, we cover lots of fires here at the station on Take 2. So by extension, we also talk a lot about evacuations and evacuation procedures, something agencies are constantly finessing. In your opinion, Kate, what went right this time around and what could have been done better?
What went right to me was that residents were getting out of those areas. Sometimes during evacuations, we see residents wanting to hold back, not want to leave their homes because they're afraid they're not going to be able to get in. They think they're going to be able to save their own home with a garden hose. We really saw a lot of residents evacuating on those evacuation orders, which is what we want to see. But in terms of improvements, every single incident that we respond to, we find ways to improve. We're learning lessons every single time. And one of the ways we are always trying to improve is to reduce that time between the start of an incident, that first flicker of flame, to the moment we can notify people of what they need to do. And so what we have to do, though, is balance quickness with effective messaging and accuracy. And so we always want to ensure that, you know, we don't want to jump the gun and give you too little information that causes people to be confused, you know. You know, a lot of studies say people don't panic, but if we give you not enough information to make the right decision for your family, you might go looking to other sources, you might go looking to rumors and incorrect information. So we want to make sure that we have the correct information for you that we send out, and that we're also getting as many methods as possible. We talked before about wireless emergency alerts versus texting versus phone calls. Every method that you add on is another kind of, you know, step in the development of those alerts. And so are we using a robo voice to call you based on some text that we enter into the system, or are we recording a voice that gives you more personalized information? Those are all questions that we have to weigh during those initial response phases.
And that is a tricky part for you guys, right? Because, yeah, people go online, go to Twitter, go to social media, and then maybe get information that they should not be getting. How do you figure out how to get the right information to the right people? That's got to be the toughest part of this.
Absolutely. And so we do work out in these communities quite a bit, helping them prepare and understand their hazards. We actually have folks in our department who will go out to neighborhoods and plan with you ahead of disaster for your specific street even. And part of that is educating people about the hazards in their area, what they can expect from us. And when we tell you evacuate, what does that mean? When we tell you shelter in place, what does that mean?
Now, I know this particular fire came at night, very fast moving. Kate, what can be done to get out the word a lot faster?
So with any fire, we want to ensure that we are getting the alerts out as quickly and accurately as possible. And so we're always working with our police and our fire partners to make sure that we have those lines of communication open, flowing, and they can request those alerts. So one of the things that we're trying to do is push the alerting as close to the incident as possible. And what that means is we don't want a firefighter on the ground who's having to choose between saving a home and firing off an emergency alert. But what we do want to do is ensure that the field is aware of the resource. They know who they can request it from, and we can do that very quickly.
Now, the fire is now 45% contained. All evacuations have been lifted. However, there are still alerts being sent out to residents through your department. What kinds of messages should they be on the lookout for now?
One of the ways that we can use our opt-in alert system is to let you know that we have recovery resources available. And so in the coming days, we'll be opening a local assistance center for residents in those areas who are impacted by the fire. Maybe they lost a home, had significant damages. If you own a business that was impacted by the fire, you can come down to that local assistance center and we can connect you with the right city, county, state, and maybe even federal resources to get you hopefully made whole again.
That's Kate Hutton. She's with the Los Angeles Emergency Management Department. Kate, thanks a lot.
No worries. Thanks.
Now, when you get something delivered that requires to be packed in foam, what do you do with it? I mean, you'd be forgiven if you thought, well, it's foam. I can't put that in the blue bin, can I? Well, it turns out, depending on where you live, that for the most part, you can put that foam in that bin. But therein lies the foam rub. Just because you can put it there, that doesn't mean it's actually getting recycled. Coming up, find out where that foam is going when Take 2 continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you've gotten takeout food at any point over the last few decades, you've probably gotten it in a foam container. Expanded polystyrene, or EPS, is a form of plastic, and it's also one of the biggest sources of marine litter in the world. Because even though many cities claim to recycle styrofoam, almost none of it is recovered and reused. And when the stuff we're supposed to or want to recycle has no place to go, it often winds up right in the ground. Well, don't just take it from me. Here's Curtis Jordan, City of Burbank Landfill Supervisor.
California does not have unlimited landfill space. And now we have introduced recyclable material to the landfill that was never designated to come here to begin with.
Gina Pollack produced a story about this for the KCET program SoCal Connected called Life in Plastic. Gina, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
So right off the bat, styrofoam, the word styrofoam, we use it all the time. Is that the right word to use for that stuff that's in packaging?
Right. So it's a little bit similar to Xerox. Mm-hmm. Styrofoam, the word, is actually trademarked by one manufacturer of styrofoam, which is Dow Chemical.
Huh.
The technical name for styrofoam is actually expanded polystyrene. So that's the stuff with, you know, the little white balls that are all connected.
Yeah.
It's used for takeout containers. It's used often for packaging technology like televisions. And there's also a kind of polystyrene that's more compressed, and it's actually not what we would normally think of as foam.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything with a number 6 on it. So if you look on the bottom of any plastic and you see a number 6, it's actually made from the same material as styrofoam. So if you want to get technical, we could just call it expanded polystyrene, or we could call it foam.
Foam. Let's just go with foam.
Let's go with foam.
That's easier.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the dirty secret of recycling is that it doesn't matter what you put into the blue bin. If there's no one to buy it, it's trash. So tell us, how much foam is actually being bought by recyclers?
So the most recent data from the EPA that I could find is from 2015. And that data suggests that the rate for all polystyrene, so including those lids, including the takeout containers, is 1.3%. Only some of that is actually foam. So it's probably below 1%. And also, as a lot of people already know, China used to accept a lot of our cheapest plastics.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
One of those plastics was number 6, which is polystyrene. So we don't have the data from the EPA after China stopped accepting it. It's probably a lot lower now. If you think about it logically, I would say 98 to 99% of the foam that we use every day is not being recycled. It's going to a landfill.
Well, that's a swift kick in the gut right there, because most people take this seriously and they put in extra effort, Gina, to try and separate things and make sure they feel better about themselves. And now to know that it's almost doesn't matter, it's kind of tough.
One of the things we found is that DART, which is a company that creates a lot of foam products, had put these signs all over restaurants in Los Angeles and Pasadena that said, now you can recycle your foam at home. And these posters are actually still there in some restaurants. They said they put them up in 2013 with permission from the city. But we found one a couple months ago. One of my other producers found one of these posters. And so it's a bit misleading, because the posters are saying, all you have to do is rinse it out and you can put it in your bin. It's great. It's recyclable. When actually it's not. And so I think that the messages that we've gotten about this product are very confusing and oftentimes misleading.
And that company, DART, you mentioned what they make. They make a lot of stuff. I mean, they make knives, plastic forks. You mentioned the cups, the takeout containers, solo cups. That's what I'm sure every college kid at some point has
yes.
held a solo cup in their hand.
Yes.
And they're a huge player when it comes to making single-use styrofoam. They promote it, as you said, as recyclable, even if it's not necessarily doable. So let's get to some of their websites, because they have Home for Foam, Foam Facts. You guys at SoCal Connected called 46 California foam drop-off centers. They list there. Let's hear a bit of that attempt.
I'm just wondering if you guys take foam. Do you guys take foam? I'm wondering if you guys take foam to recycle. Not at all.
All right, so they don't take foam, but at least the numbers that were being called were actually recycling centers, right?
And you guys are a recycling facility, just to be clear? Your finance company?
So, Tina, this was on DART's websites that they promote as, look at our websites, go find a recycling center. I mean, how frustrating was that for you guys to make these phone calls and realize that it wasn't really working?
So DART on their website, they have a whole tab to these maps. One of them is this website called Home for Foam. They have another website called Foam Facts that they link to. Yeah. And the map has all of these places around. It looks like they're everywhere and you can just drop it off. We had this giant Google spreadsheet where we took all of the places from their map, and we took every group we could possibly find, every drop-off center we could possibly find, and we called all of them. And it was pretty frustrating because I think it's asking a lot already of the consumer to take your phone, wash it off, save it in a bag, and then you're going to have to look at the map and you're going to have to figure out where to drive it. Not only do you have to do that, but you also have to call first to make sure they're going to take that foam. And then, you know, you're not even sure where it's going to go. Are they selling it somewhere in Korea? Are they selling it to Indianapolis? We don't really know. But how many people do you know who are collecting their foam and they're going to drive it somewhere?
Yeah, not many people, if any, that I know at all. I know that I haven't even thought of doing that. We're talking to Gina Pollack. Yeah. She produced a story called Life in Plastic for the KCET program SoCal Connected. Now, when it comes to DART, though, they're also extremely politically active. They donate a lot of money to lobbyists who campaign against legislation that would ban the foam. How successful have DART and other plastic makers been in killing bills that would kill foam?
So they've been hugely successful at this. And I think what was really surprising is they're not just lobbying at the state level, just in Sacramento. They also send representatives to city councils all across America. We found footage of them at city councils here in Pasadena, city council meetings in Los Angeles. Every time there's a ban being considered that would eliminate foam, they send a representative there. That person makes a great speech. And we found that between 2017 and 2018, DART spent about $2 million in lobbying.
Yeah, that's a lot of financial muscle there.
Yeah.
So this brings us to the city of LA, which is supposed to ban foam by 2021 as part of a Green New Deal that Mayor Eric Garcetti has put out there. Your story says that LA really dropped the ball on the polystyrene ban that the city has known it was a problem since 1988. That's when Tom Bradley, when he was the mayor, instructed his staff to stop using it at city facilities. What's your take on whether LA will actually follow through citywide?
Right. So it's kind of shocking, actually, that Los Angeles hasn't banned foam. About 100 other cities across California have. You know, Santa Monica's banned it. Pasadena has banned it. Long Beach, Malibu, tons of other cities. But LA is kind of what one activist told me is the kind of big enchilada. If the foam lobbyists lose LA, that's a really big deal because we have a huge restaurant industry and it's really important for them to keep it from being banned.
Is it on us, the people that buy the stuff that is in these foam containers? Is it on the people that make the containers to make it easier for us? Or how about our people that we elect? I mean, who ultimately is this on to at least try and figure out a way to make this something that won't kill the earth later on?
So it's a complicated question. I think it's on kind of everyone, but from a lot of the people that I spoke to, it really should be on the manufacturers. And there are ways to do that. You know, there's something called closed loop recycling, where if I'm DART and I make a product, I have to take it back and recycle it. That's how they do it in a lot of places in Europe and across the world. Here, you know, in the US, we don't put as much pressure on manufacturers. We're kind of like, great, just put it out there and the cities will be the ones to take care of it. But some of the people at the city described it as like, we can't fix it from the front end. We're just dealing with the back end. We have all of this waste coming at us and we're just trying to sort it and sell it. We're doing the best we can, but we cannot deal with all of this waste. So it's really on the manufacturers to figure out what to do with their products and to take responsibility for them.
That was Gina Pollack, producer for the KCET program SoCal Connected. Her episode on polystyrene foam recycling called Life in Plastic airs tonight at 8 p.m. on KCET and also KCET.org. Gina, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
2018 was a good year for women who ran for elected office. Record-setting year, actually. So, say you're a woman who has been inspired by what happened then and would like to try your own campaign, but you're not sure how to start, or even if you're running for the right reasons and how to identify what those right reasons are. Well, it's all been written down in a new book. Hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. 2018 broke a lot of records for the midterm elections. It was dubbed the Year of the Woman, and here's why. A record 117 women won elections across the U.S., 100 Democrats and 17 Republicans. And before that, in 2016, Hillary Clinton ran for president as a Democratic Party nominee. During tonight's Democratic presidential debate, four of the 12 candidates on stage are women. So it appears that a roadmap for women interested in getting elected exists. But if, for whatever reason, it's still tough to see, well, it's been written down in a new book, and that book is called Represent, The Woman's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. Actress and comedian June Diane Raphael wrote it, co-wrote it actually, with Kate Black. It's actually an inviting book written in a very conversational style. So when I sat down with June recently, I started by asking why she wrote it that way.
I really wanted the book to be accessible, and yes, dare I say fun. I think the idea of serving the public and speaking up on the things that make us crazy, the things that we care about, the things that we love, what sort of ignites our passion, what we're tweeting about, what we're yelling at our family members over Thanksgiving about, the idea that we could translate that into having a voice at the table and actually affecting change in a real way and bridging that gap to me is really important. So much of this book is the conversation between me and my co-author, Kate. I'm asking all the questions that I think so many people have. What's the first thing I should do? Where would I run for? What office fits and solves the problems that I see in my community? And what should I wear? I mean, really, the basics.
Okay, June, so let's just say there's a woman who's decided she wants to run for office. She knows why she wants to run, knows why it's important to her. What's the first step she needs to do to make it feel and seem real?
Start telling people. And I was shocked at that advice from Kate when we first started talking about the process, because, and I know I'm not the only woman who feels this way, so many of us want to have it all figured out. We want to know the plan, know the dates, know how much money we need to raise, have done the trainings a number of times, and we want to have it all just so before we can take that step. And the truth is, men are not waiting. You know, there's a great statistic in the book where we talk about how when they polled all these men and all these women, of the men who actively say, I'm not qualified to run for office, 40% of them are still willing to put their hat in the ring, which blew my mind, where women, of course, suffer from feeling underqualified. So, yes, we recommend that women start talking about it immediately.
It's accountability, right? That's, I mean, when you put it out there, people hear it. They're like, hey, what about you running? Didn't you say you wanted to run?
Absolutely. And for women especially, raising money early is super important. Women have a harder time fundraising. Women of color have an even harder time fundraising. So telling people early, getting them involved, does two things. It ignites them and your supporters early on, and it also commits you further to the process.
It's written in red in the book, and you mentioned it. Men are not waiting. There's periods in between each. And I got to admit, June, when I read that, I thought of my two granddaughters. One is 9, one is 5. They'll be young women soon, but it made me think that even in this day and age, that I might have to someday remind them that if they want to go out and get something in life, that they have to act because men are not waiting. So why do you think women today are still waiting?
Oh, gosh. Well, because we live in a misogynistic white supremacist society. And I think we've internalized a lot of negative messaging around being a woman. I think we have a lot of work to do on how we've internalized that and sort of unlearning those really damaging messages about ourselves. And it is very hard.
Talking to June Diane Raphael, who co-wrote Represent, The Woman's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. June, what's the biggest difference between when a man decides to run for office compared to when a woman decides to do it?
Well, my biggest takeaway is just the amount of money that, and then this is, by the way, I should tell our listeners that when we were writing the book, one of the challenges and the tensions that's in the book is talking to all women about all different races. You may not have to raise that much money if you're running for neighborhood council in rural Idaho.
Or city council as opposed to governor or something.
Exactly.
Like that,
yeah. So the scope of these things can change wildly. But I would say the biggest difference for men and women is just men usually have more access to wealth. They have spent centuries investing in each other and building businesses together, and women simply across the board do not have the same access to wealth. And that is one of the biggest barriers running for office.
One of the things I kind of noticed as I was reading is that a candidate's past. It seems like men can get away with all kinds of weird things in their past, but a woman all of a sudden gets raked over the coals. So what? How do you know, maybe say on the internet, what's safe to keep, what's safe to let live, what's something you got to delete?
I mean, it's hard, and it's hard for me to prescribe this because I actually tip my hat to so many women who are changing that conversation in with their candidacies and having photos out there of themselves. And we have some examples of this in the book where they are not apologizing. And when they do that, they open up space for the rest of us to live more boldly, to live more fully, to present ourselves in and our sexuality in its full, our full humanity, really. So we don't have to feel that to be a leader, you have to look and sound one certain way. So I tip my hat to those women. Hmm. For the average woman who's reading this book, is it a good idea to do an inventory of what's out there about you online, what you've posted? Of course. We do recommend starting a separate social media pages and handles and accounts for yourself as the candidate and making your own private account private. That's a simple hot tip right
there.
Good
advice in general, I think.
In general. Yeah. We recommend starting Google alerts about yourself and really doing that deep dive into what's out there about you online. Now, you can choose to embrace it. You can choose to do many different things with it. But I do think it's a good idea to simply know so you're prepared to address it in whatever way feels right.
Now, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but men in the United States in politics have had it pretty good for about 200 years, particularly white dudes. I don't know if anyone's seen that, but
I haven't noticed. That's so weird.
It's something that's been, it's in the paper. Things are starting to maybe even out. Maybe that process is starting. What sounds like a fair division to you of elected offices?
Oh, wow. Great question. I mean, I think a representative government is a better government. And so I would love to see people at the table who are actually representative of this country. Again, women make up half the population. Yeah, I believe it's equitable. And this is why I want Republican women to run as well. And the book is written in a nonpartisan way. Within that group of women, I would like to see a really diverse group of women at the table.
Okay, I want to get to the first sentence of your book's dedication. It reads like this. We dedicate this book to all the men who have been making decisions about women without women. June, that got me thinking about Martin Luther King's dream for all Americans to one day be judged solely by the content of their character. Is that just not possible anymore? Will politicians always be judged by race, religion, or for what we're talking about here, their gender?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't want, you know, we try really not to fall into an essentialist trap in this book because, of course, there are many women leaders who are not advocating for women and families and for the things that women care about. And there are many men who are. So I don't think it's necessary. However, I do believe firmly in we the people, meaning all people. And I do think that something's wrong when we have such disparity in our government.
June Diane Raphael is an actor and comedian who co-wrote Represent, The Woman's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. June, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, make sure you listen tonight at 5 for the next Democratic presidential debate. KPCC will have NPR's live coverage hosted by Audie Cornish with NPR's fact-checking and analysis. All right, if you missed any part of the show today, just go to wherever you find your podcast. Look for us there. We will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.